TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, it's a question I wanted to pose to you before we get started.
Oh, yeah, please.
What if I told you that I knew someone who could bring stability to Bajor, someone who could unite the factions and give us a chance to do our job?
So you're going to give Kira the runabout?
Is there anybody that she has not talked to about this? Seriously, it's even beyond the station. It's now talking to podcasters about it. I mean, she must really want that.
Well, I think it's because she tweeted.
Is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. So.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess I'll give her the runabout because if I don't, we're not going to have much to talk about today as we continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine and we jump into season two. We're finally here, the first episode of season two, The Homecoming. And here is a quick rundown of the story. Life on the station seems to be back to normal. As we head into season two, people are enjoying Dabo, Quark is up to something, Odo is investigating, Jake has a date, but things quickly go sideways with the arrival of an earring. Recognizing a legendary resistance fighter's insignia on the jewelry, Kira leads a mission to retrieve him from a Cardassian prison camp, potentially starting a war in the process. Thankfully, Gul Dukat prefers to cover his butt rather than start shooting. Factions on Bajor, however, have less peaceful intentions as they first tag the station walls before moving on to Quark's head. So, Matthew, we are at the start of a new day for the station and Deep Space Nine and Star Trek, really, because we've got a different style of storytelling kicking off the season.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we mentioned many times as we were talking through the first season, we were noticing the ways in which this is very different than TNG, and it is setting itself apart from TNG in that way. And I do think that the beginning of this first season clearly kind of sets itself apart from the formula that TNG had created in itself. And this, and I think the reason that is and the way in which they decide to do that, we are going to focus on the very thing to which we're here to do. Because, you know, Deep Space Nine and Sisko have a very specific mission for being in this part of the galaxy, which is the goal is to ready the Bajorans to be a part of the Federation, to join the Federation at some point. And so, therefore, this whole episode really picks up on that idea and the fact that they've been there a year, they've made a lot of progress, but now they're starting to see that kind of slip away with all of this internal infighting on Bajor with the provisional government. And I think what that creates is a real sense of like continuity for the show. And it helps you to then understand the first season in light of, oh, look how far we've come. Because, you know, when you follow up from In the Hands of the Prophets, where it really seemed like Sisko was bringing people together, they're really working together well. Obviously, him and Kira working really well together, which is kind of a good microcosm of the macro. And then to see that that is somewhat falling by the wayside now is an incredibly interesting mm-hmm. thing to do. So, you know, I just find it to be exciting, the fact that we're trying, you know, something new in the Star Trek realm. And I think that is just really, really interesting. And it's really fun, right? That we're going to make everything that came before really, really important, right? Mm-hmm. And so whether you kind of liked all the episodes from season one and to start with, it lets you know that those adventures are important for the overall mission that we've been sent here in the first place for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting taking a moment here, because we're now leaving season one behind, we're getting into season two, just thinking back about that mission that you talk about that's set up so clearly in the pilot in Emissary and is concluded so well with In the Hands of the Prophets to end season mm-hmm. one. But in between, it feels like maybe it would be fair to say that the writers lost their focus at times along the way, where we get those stories that do feel like they could be TNG stories. There's always this thread of continuity that mm-hmm. runs through season one of DS9, but it isn't focused in the way that this trilogy that starts season two absolutely. Is.
Yeah.
And then where the story goes from here on out, even though in season two, it's still not the type of kind of driving narrative that we're accustomed to later in the series.
Right. Yeah.
But I think the idea of refocusing the writing on why we are here, as you said, was really important for, I don't know if it was important for making DS9 a success at the time, because DS9 wasn't necessarily viewed as a success at the time. But when you look at the series today and you see the strength of it and how the stories stand the test of time and mm-hmm. how they remain so relevant and why it is now viewed as by many as the best of all of the Star Trek series, mm-hmm. I think that focusing in the way that they do here, which was a directive that Michael Piller gave to the writers going mm-hmm. into the season, was just so key, and it was so important to do. And another thing that I find interesting about the opening of this episode, the very, very opening of the episode, is that you mentioned that Sisko is bringing people together. He and Kira are working together a lot better. And that is set up in the Hands of the Prophets. But what's also set up in the Hands of the Prophets is that there's something brewing on Bajor.
Yes.
That's going to throw a wrench into the plans. Mm-hmm. But when this episode opens, it feels like, as I said in the little rundown of the story there, it feels like life is a bit brighter on the station at this point. Like people have moved on from the events of In the Hands of the Prophets, and it isn't quite clear how much time has passed mm-hmm. because DS9 famously doesn't give its episodes star dates very often.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
Unknown is the most common star date for a DS9 episode.
Yeah, I mean, just real quickly on that, I mean, the only time stamp that we have is basically that it's been a year.
It's been a year,
so
right?
They basically are counting the first season as like an entire year there.
Yeah, which makes sense.
So, which, yeah.
So, but In the Hands of the Prophets is 2369 and The Homecoming is 2370. So we still don't know, has it been 3 months? Has it been 6 months? Has it been almost a year? We don't know how much time has really passed, mm-hmm. but you get this feeling going in that things have kind of settled down and life on the station has settled into a groove. And I think that's a really nice way to kick off the story before throwing this big twist at us with Kira and Lee and and the circle.
And this is the thing too, again, just kind of coming back to this idea of differentiating ourselves from TNG, you know, the mission of Sisko and of the crew here on Deep Space Nine is incredibly different from the crew of any other Starfleet characters that we've seen, which is their mission is to help this planet come out of the place where it's been, which is, you know, they have been completely and utterly decimated by a Holocaust, basically, that's been perpetrated on them by another race. And so we're trying to help that culture then rebuild itself so that it can hopefully at some point join us in the United Federation of Planets. Even if that's not the case, we really want them just to be able to stand on their own two feet again and not have to worry about, you know, being overtaken by another race like the Cardassians again. And so what I think is so great about, you know, the kind of the way you put this on the outline is we're clearly showing that we have a very clear direction for this show, which is we are not forgetting the reason that we set up this show in the first place, in the first season. No, we are going to abide by that. And in fact, not only are we going to abide by it, but we're going to dig into that. Like, that is going to be the thing then that becomes more important. And whether or not the Bajorans at the time were popular, the writers doubled down on this idea of that's why we're here and that's what distinguishes us from the other shows that have been out there. So, we don't know if you're going to like it. But again, we're doubling down. You know, I think like you rightly pointed out, in the end, that actually becomes the thing that because it sets Deep Space Nine apart, right, in that way, there's something then that's really special about that, right?
Yeah, it prevents it from blending in with all the other series when you look at the big picture.
Yeah.
Not that all the series are the same. Every series has its distinctive characteristics, but what all the other series have in common is you've got a crew on a starship going places and doing things. And then this one is just really different. And
yes,
at the time, you'll recall there were rumblings from fans about how slow the show was and it's boring because we're on this station and we don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
We're not Star Trekking, right? We're not getting out there. And they could have easily listened to that and said, you know, we need to retool. We need to just give the fans what they're expecting, which is we're going to get on a ship and go around.
Yeah.
And they kind of do that a little bit later when they introduce the Defiant. But they never actually move away from the station as being the center of everything.
No, they don't.
And I do wonder if Voyager had not been in development, if they would have stuck to their guns on this one and said, look, we're just going to make this show distinctively different. It's going to be here on the station. We're going to deal with local politics and religion and so forth. It's probably a good thing that Voyager was in the works. And so they had another outlet for that.
Yeah. And you know, you saying that, I think in many ways, it's something to which, you know, the writers of Deep Space Nine have talked about, and they've talked many times about the idea that, they honestly didn't care about us. They let us do our thing because they were bringing in this new show. And so, you know, what they cared about was that. And that allowed us then to do whatever it is we wanted to do, basically. And not to say that that becomes almost like an evidence here, but I think that in some ways for season two, you can already see that it started, right? Like the studio, because it's so focused on Voyager, they're not paying attention to what's going on in Deep Space Nine. And so again, allowing them then to run with the storytelling that truly sets this in a place and a time and allows them, as we've said many times, just on the Orb in general, to create a show to which the thematic elements are going to be ones to which can continue to speak to us over the years because we're utilizing these archetypal understandings of history and all that. We're not trying to tie anything into one specific time period, but we're doing these things to which, you know, anybody can look to and be like, oh my gosh, I totally can see that in the time I'm in. 20 years later, you're like, oh, I can totally see that in the time I'm in. And that's what makes, you know, the show so successful and so interesting then in that way. So,
yeah. And that's something that it's true of many, many episodes of Star Trek across all the series, that the particular thing that they're talking about still resonates with you years and years later, because it's just, it's something that's recurring in human behavior or society. But the difference here is that it's not just one episode, right? It's a long, drawn out, deep exploration of a focused issue in a focused situation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so it's, and I think, you know, maybe that's one of the things where, you know, you had, just on our thought process outline for the episode, that there is an enduring relevance to this show, as we were just talking about. And so to, and this allows us, I think, to kind of dive a little bit into the story, this idea, like you mentioned, that Bajor, is experiencing this upheaval as they try to find their way through the aftermath of what they've gone through with the Cardassians. And what it's leading to is this idea of kind of a nationalistic feel, in a way that is detrimental to them instead of helpful, right? Bajor does have to learn how to be a society again in and of itself before it can join the larger society, which is one of the missions. That's what makes this so hard for Picard. But there's a group here who wants to take that in, into a completely almost isolationist sense, which would be very dangerous then for Bajor. And I think that that's so interesting because, again, that feels so relevant to just about any time that you're watching this show. I mean, there are are pieces of that in many countries around the world right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it endures because it's a cyclical aspect of human society, right? In the world today, we're seeing many movements towards isolationism and protectionist ideas that echo things that happened 100 years ago. And then we opened up. There was a lot of globalization. In the case of the Federation of the Bajorans here, I used the word galacticization, which is very hard to pronounce. And also hard to write, but then it's like pulling a rubber band and then it popping back, right? And it just happens over and over throughout history. And right now we're heading back into a period where a lot of people feel like, well, we're better off on our own. We don't need everybody else. And that's what we're seeing with the Bajorans here in the circle. And as you said, it would be detrimental to them because they're coming out of this situation where their planet has just been robbed of resources and their civilization has been seriously damaged by this occupation, and they need assistance.
Yeah.
It's easy to understand why some people might feel like we're going to blame all of our problems on outsiders. And let's kick all the outsiders out. The circle here, they want Bajor for Bajorans. But at the same time, they don't actually have the resources and the infrastructure at the moment to properly take care of themselves if they don't have any involvement with people from the outside. And then you've got the Federation here who's here to try to help them recover. And then you've got a group that wants to push them away. And that's, you know, the core of the story that's being built here at the start of this trilogy, a Star Trek threesome, shall we say, to start season two. And it's a very relevant story for us to watch today. And it's also a very strong foundation to build, to flesh out the mythology of Deep Space Nine that was already set up in season one to really make this a strong series.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I really like about this is that there really is an importance for Bajor of figuring out who they are after the Cardassian occupation. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of being more inward focused is right, correct, and makes sense. But then the idea that they don't need anyone's help in doing that is probably not the best thought in their minds. And rejecting any help, I think is not really going to be helpful for them. Mm-hmm. And so the beauty of this is that you can truly understand their thought process, you know, and this is the kind of thing that is great because, you know, this is what Sisko has been kind of fighting against this whole time, which is we're not here to do what the Cardassians did to you. We're just here to give you the opportunity to do that exploration of who you need to be and figure that out. And then if you want to join us in the end, that's great. If you don't, that's also fine too, but we're not the Cardassians. And so again, you can kind of understand as to why there would be people on Bajor who would be terrified that they're just going to fall into another trap, you know? And so,
yeah, I'm not sure that there are many Bajorans who would view the Federation as potentially doing the same thing to them that the Cardassians did, but they would feel that they lost their self-determination under the Cardassians and they're still going to not have self-determination with the Federation here, even though the Federation isn't going to rob the planet or imprison the people. Still, someone else is making decisions for us and we don't want that.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think that it does make sense because, and I can understand how and why people might think that, because with the trauma that you've experienced the last 50 years under Cardassian occupation, you know, it doesn't, there's a lot of places in which you're not necessarily going to be thinking completely rationally because of that. And so therefore, I get that. And it makes sense to me. And as we're mentioning, the beauty of this too is just how relevant then that this continues to be as we look at our world today. And, you know, the whole thought process of people kind of wanting to be isolationist in a dangerous way is really interesting. I mean, every country has to look to take care of itself, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's also something that is dangerous about the fact of like completely withdrawing from the rest of the world as if that doesn't have an impact on you as well. And so all of that is, that's the greatness of, I mean, we've said so many times, like, you know, you can watch Deep Space Nine episode and then like 10 years later you watch it and you're like, you're thinking new things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And that's I love it about this show. That's one of my favorite things about this show.
Yeah. Well, sometimes taking care of yourself in the best way possible means cooperating and collaborating with others. It doesn't always mean going it on your own. And that's something that I think often gets lost in protectionist views. And, you know, we see that today. We see it here with the Bajorans and especially like in the context of Star Trek, when you've got this Federation at the center, which is made up of so many different cultures that have all worked together to achieve a good life for most of the citizens of the Federation, you can see the value of that cooperation and diversity. And by giving a story like this that pushes back against this, I think Deep Space Nine, it challenges the ideals of Star Trek in a way that still fits well within the story. We've seen this a little bit, like in the J.J. Abrams films. I remember the trailer for Star Trek Beyond, where the idea is pushing back, like, don't come into our backyard anymore, Federation. You know, we're pushing back against you. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think DS9 did it very effectively years and years and years before that through stories like this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is kind of the thing that the writers of Deep Space Nine did really well. They knew that they wanted to be able to talk about the world around them, but then they did that in a way that could transcend just one moment in time, because mm-hmm. these are things to which we've been dealing with as the human race for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that just makes this then work. And as you're watching it and you're kind of feeling like you're seeing your own time period, it's great. And I love it that that's the case. So, and the beauty of this, though, is that this is not just allegory for allegory's sake. What it mm-hmm. is it's creating a very interesting story then for the mission that Sisko's on, and it's throwing a wrench into that mission, which mm-hmm. then helps you unravel other stories to continue to tell and keep this interesting as a show, which that's the thing I think is most interesting.
So if we roll back to our talk about TNG versus DS9 a little bit here, just in connection to this story that they're telling and how they set this up. One thing that is interesting about the Homecoming, and it would really encompass the whole Circle trilogy here, is that Jerry Taylor originally pitched this story as a Next Generation episode. And they would have had the Enterprise D carrying a Bajoran woman, and she would be on a mission to rescue a Bajoran resistance leader. And then Michael Piller, in that directive that he had already given the writers and in his thought process of, well, how do we set DS9 on its own, grabbed the idea, of course, working with Jerry Taylor on that. Jerry Taylor and Ira Stephen Bear together wrote the story for The Homecoming, and then Ira did the teleplay. But Piller pulled that over and said, hey, you know, this is actually what we need to set up this idea of what DS9 is and what the mission is and tie it into Bajor and so forth. And I think it's really interesting that he was able to do that. And then Ira took the concept of the resistance leader mm-hmm. and transformed him into he's still a leader of sorts, but he's a mistaken hero. There's this story that, there's this myth about him, and he tells the story to Sisko later in the mm-hmm. episode. But it was just such a successful way to decouple DS9 from TNG using a story that was originally conceived of for TNG itself.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things that I'm just so glad that happened, right? That they decided this needed to be the storyline for Deep Space Nine. It just doesn't really make a lot of sense for this to be a TNG story.
It would have worked before DS9 premiered, like the episodes that set up the Bajorans. Mm-hmm. If it were part of that, maybe it would have made more sense. But once you're rolling here...
Yes.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't make so much sense to put that on the other series.
Right. No, 100%. And so I think they made the right choice in giving this to Deep Space Nine. And I mean, again, I just, it's crazy to me to almost even think that they had a thought that we should tell this as a TNG story, when it's like, no, TNG passed off the baton. They set up all of this stuff for Deep Space Nine with the Bajorans and the Cardassians. Like, why would you try and steal that in some ways from them?
Well, I think it's probably because Jerry Taylor had been working on
the TNG stuff.
And so that's where her thought process was, is, well, what stories can we tell here?
Yeah. And I definitely get that. And I that's not a terrible thing, but I mean, it's just one of those places where I think somebody saying, hey, I think this is a Deep Space Nine story, and this will allow Deep Space Nine to actually continue the mission we gave it in the first place, just makes so much more sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, one problem, though, for Jerry Taylor with this story being moved over to DS9 is that her final writing credit for The Next Generation is Sub Rosa.
I mean, you know, Star Trek After Dark was very popular for one episode. So,
yeah. All right. So the story itself, with the original idea of having a Bajoran woman on a mission to rescue a resistance leader, that becomes Kira and Lee Nalis. We talked a lot so far in our rewatch about the rich character development for Kira throughout season one. And they just dive right back into that here with the opening of season two. Once again, exploring how Kira views her people, how she connects with the, because she was so involved herself in fighting the occupation, how she connects with the stories of others who fought as well. And, you know, the moment that Quark shows her that earring, she's just focused on, okay, where did you get this? She identifies that it belonged to Lee Nalis, and she believes so strongly that if she could retrieve him, that he would be the figure that could unite Bajor. What are your thoughts on her view of the situation and what they're doing with the character here?
Yeah, I think, one, it's incredibly interesting to me that Kira has really learned her lesson in a lot of ways about kind of the ways in which to deal with Sisko, right? She goes to him, she asks for the runabout, he says he's going to think about it. Obviously, she does talk to other people behind the scenes.
A lot of other people.
Yes, but instead of continuing to kind of pester Sisko, you know, she allows Sisko, it's almost as though she's learned how Sisko thinks, and she knows that he is going to process with Dax. So it's one of the reasons that they talk together. And and so what I was really impressed by is that we have truly taken this character a step. That's what's great. Because, you know, unfortunately, that doesn't really happen all that much with a lot of the other Star Trek shows. It feels like it can take forever for a character to actually move forward. And so for that to happen was wonderful. You know, just as the actual story of Kira herself being worried about her people and feeling kind of hamstrung as to what to do about it, and then seeing this person to which the legend of him is so strong that she believes that he could be the answer. I mean, that's incredibly interesting, right? And the beauty of that is that the person we know as the legend is exactly the type of person who would be able to do that. And yet the beauty of this story is that we're going to flip that on its head. And we're not going to just automatically make this easy. In fact, it's going to get really difficult because, you know, this is going to be a person who doesn't want to do this at all. And not only do they not want to do it at all, but they actually know in their heart they're not actually the person that everybody thinks that they are. And that, to me, is such interesting storytelling. Like that, because almost in some ways I feel like if you told this story, I feel like on TNG, I don't know if we would have gone to the depth that we have in this episode, mm-hmm. where not only do we take the story for us, you know, trying to get this person back, we also take it to the whole level of the Cardassians still having prisoners of war, to all of that. I mean, all of that, it seems like that's all stuff that they would do. But then the mm-hmm. added level of this guy just being like, yeah, and I don't even want to do this because I'm not that person. The person everybody mm-hmm. thinks I am, I'm not. And so, oh man, it's just so great.
Well, I think it shows that the person that is a true leader or can be seen and be effective as a true leader isn't someone who sees themselves that way necessarily, mm-hmm. right? People, in his case, I mean, there's a lot going on with him, which is, you know, it is fascinating how complex they make this character, but he has this belief that everything that people think about him is a lie because mm-hmm. of how something happened. And then he tried to explain that he didn't really kill that Cardassian in some kind of glorious battle. He basically tripped and the Cardassian yeah. died. But the others with him wanted to believe something else mm-hmm. and he couldn't convince them otherwise. Yeah. And because of that, he feels like a fraud. You know, a term we hear often these days among professionals is imposter syndrome.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And many people yep. who are extraordinarily skilled and experienced at their job still feel like they're imposters. Mm-hmm. And those types of people can be good leaders because they're very good at what they do. They can really teach others, but they don't have that ego getting in the way. And that's not entirely applicable to what's going on with Lee Nollis, but I think that it's certainly why Sisko sees the potential mm-hmm. in him
yeah.
to help pull Bajor together. Because unlike Kira, who believes the stories and the legend of Lee Nollis, Sisko listens to the explanation and says, okay, yeah, I get it. But, you know, that's not a lie. Mm-hmm. It's a legend, and legends can be as powerful as any truth, he yeah. tells Lee Nollis.
Yep.
And sometimes people just need a symbol. They need to believe in something, and that's what you can give them.
Well, and as you're mentioning, sometimes a legend can be and as we see in stories, like the legend can be as important almost as the truth. But at the same time, and this is the thing that the one thing the episode doesn't do that I think would have been really interesting was the idea of telling a person it is not quite as important on whether or not you actually did this thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what matters is the character of you as a person to be a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing that I'm just kind of struck by, is that because Lee Nollis is a person who does not want to lead, it actually makes him the perfect person then to lead.
Yeah.
And right, right. And so that's one of the things that we don't actually really get as a conversation, at least here in this episode. And it is something to which I think is the thing then that even when, you know, Sisko learns the story, he still sees this him as a person who could still really be good for Bajor. And part mm-hmm. of that is that, you know, Lee Nollis is a person who does still care just about Bajor.
Yeah.
And that's really what Bajor needs. It needs somebody who cares for Bajor and not for the power that they are going to accumulate because of it.
Right. And that's the other part of the story, is what's going on with Jaro. And what we saw at the end of season one with Wynn. Mm-hmm. And what's also interesting, what they've set up here, is that they ended season one with the religious elements of Bajoran society having an issue with diversity of thought and others being there on their planet and having an influence on their people and their culture. And then here you've got the politicians. So you've got both voices, which are very powerful in societies, sort of saying the same thing, but for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Although there is a similarity with Jaro and Wynn, which is that they both seek power. And that's something that we'll see play out a bit more as well. But I think what's going on here, what we're talking about with Lee Nollis, can lead us into the other thing that I did want to talk about, which is the storytelling style of having a trilogy, which had never been done in Star Trek up to this point. And I'm going to skip the what I call an accidental trilogy with The Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, and The Voyage Home, because those kind of... it led into a three-part story, but it wasn't conceived of in the way this was, where we're going to have three stories, three episodes to tell one story. And we won't see this again until the fourth season of Enterprise with Borderlands, Cold Station 12, and The Augments. Mm-hmm. And of course, it becomes a distinctive part of Enterprise's fourth season of telling these little mini arcs. But here, what you're mentioning that we don't get about Lee Nollis in this episode is something that they know that they've got three parts to tell the story. And so they can actually develop this character and present this character to us in a way that ultimately gives us a deeper look into his psyche that you would not have been able to do on The Next Generation. You know, we were talking about, well, if they told this story on The Next Generation, they would have touched on these elements, but ultimately they would have had to resolve this by the end of the episode. And here, because they know that they've got two more episodes to work with, we're really just getting this glimpse of him. And also it allows the room for his character to breathe as someone who has spent a decade in a prison camp. Obviously, as soon as he's out and he's back on a station like this where he's safe and he's got a comfortable room to sit in by himself for a little while, it's going to take some real time to decompress from something like that. And I don't think anyone would feel differently than he does when all this stuff is being thrust on him all at once.
Yeah, I mean, and I think too that, with that specifically with Lee Nollis, it's also a person who's been in a prison camp, you know, for quite a long time. And so it's one of those things where, yes, you are asking an incredible amount from a person like him. And yet at the same time, you are in a place with Bajor where it's like you need somebody to step up. You know, you need a real leader to step up, and that real leader whole desire needs to be about the betterment of Bajor and not their own power. And, you know, that's the place where, you know, even this guy we meet and we realize he's not everything we thought he was, at the same time, he's actually, the right man for the job. He's a good man for the job, because that's not what he cares about. And so I think that that's something really, really interesting. So,
yeah. So also speaking about fighting against the occupation and military strategy is the real thing that I just want to mention here. This episode's the first time that we find out that Bashir has an interest in military strategy. And as we talk about how the writers plant seeds, they leave the strings dangling, as we've talked about over and over on the Orb for future stories, this little tidbit about Bashir having this interest is something that they can eventually build on with the relationship he has with Miles, and they spend all that time together in the holosuites. And even later on in the Dominion War, when we get to something like statistical probabilities, the fact that they've slowly, starting here, established this interest for Bashir in military strategy in the first place helps those stories, and particularly what he does with the other augmented people in statistical probabilities make more sense.
Yeah, I mean, this is a place where the show is kind of taking the characters from the first season and they're beginning to invest in them character qualities that we can play with later. You know, we've talked about many times that Deep Space Nine kind of does this thing where it drops threads for them to pick up later. And this is one of the places where they're doing that with Bashir. And, you know, maybe too, I think as you watch it in retrospect, it's a foreshadowing that Bashir is more than meets the eye, which is a really interesting thing. And so I love that. Another place that they do that, right, is they have progressed to Jake, who we can tell has grown to a guy who now wants to go on his first date, right? And what I absolutely love about that as well is that we're continuing this thread that Sisko is a single father trying to do the job of being a station commander and at the same time raise his son. And I think they handle that so well. I mean, that whole interaction between him and Jake, where Jake's like, I don't think you're ready to have this conversation yet. And it's just like, it's such a classic like father son type of discussion. It's so wonderful.
It definitely is. And I've had that experience myself. You know, my son is 25 years old now, so I've been through that whole process that Sisko is going through with Jake. And when I saw this the first time, of course, I was in university. So I'm watching it from both ends of seeing it as someone who was still very young myself, and then to this point where I've raised a son. So that's an interesting experience for me as we go back and we rewatch these things. All right. Well, to close things out here, we get to the end of the episode and we've spent a lot of time today talking about Kira and how her character has grown so much. And they give us so much Kira in this episode and we see her working together with Sisko and suddenly she's been reassigned. That was not something that you're expecting as you go through this episode for the first time, for sure.
Absolutely not. And I think the beauty of that is you can truly tell that there's something going on behind the scenes, right? I think that the tell of this is that, okay, there's something else happening here. Like there's something about, and two, I think the beauty of that is that you think of in your mind, you've got Kira here who has obviously grown close to the commander, to the people here. She's created a relationship. She obviously has been somebody who is very much had her own ups and downs with the provisional government, right? And so now the fact that they have, you know, pulled her away from that is actually almost a I would say a terrifying example of where this three-part episode series is going to go. And you know, I don't know, Chris, if you remember or not, because I don't. Do you remember if you knew coming into this season when it was airing that this was going to be a three-part series? Do you remember if they had released that information?
That's a good point. I don't think so. I think that that's something that, in retrospect, you know, we call it the Circle Trilogy now. I don't think it was ever referred to that way originally. And yeah, I don't think so. Because, you know, the title on the episode is just The Homecoming. And up to this point, any time there had been a two-parter, it was always part one and part two. Now, they didn't always put part one on the screen.
Yeah.
They would only do that if it were like mid-season, maybe. And even then, they don't always do it on TNG. But the episodes would have the same name, ultimately, with one and two. And then here, when you've got, like, if you were looking ahead and you could see the titles of the episodes coming up, you still would not have had any indication that this was a three-part story.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's something that makes this a really interesting thing, too, because, you know, it says to be continued, which you're used to there being two-parters in Star Trek. Not knowing maybe coming in, and again, it's one of those things, like, this is so long ago, we can't remember. But it's a great way to start the season. And what I think is so fun about the way it starts the season is that it's almost as though the writers are saying, you know, kind of like, buckle up. Deep Space Nine is going to be charting new territory. We're boldly going to go where no Star Trek series has gone before, but in ways that you can't possibly imagine. And so, as we've mentioned, one of the ways it does that is we are going to explore the human condition, and we're going to explore the values of the Federation, and we're going to put all of that to the test, to the max, really. And this is one of those places, I think, the series does that, where it kicks off its second season, and, you know, we're about to go in very different directions.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, any final thoughts, and what rating are you going to give this episode?
Yeah, I mean, this is just a good episode of Deep Space Nine, and it's just a good episode of Star Trek. I mean, the character work here is fantastic. I mean, we didn't even mention, although I think we absolutely could and should here as I'm wrapping up, but the work that Miles O'Brien do and the relationship that starts to bud here, and the sense of the working relationship between Kira and O'Brien is fantastic. The interplay between them as they, you know, storm this concentration camp for Bajorans here is just wonderful. I mean, their interplay, the way they sell the whole thing is fantastic. So I think that's so great. So, you know, and just every time a character is utilized here on screen, even if they only have a few moments, which all of the characters do, but not all of them get a bunch of screen time, but it really feels like the characters are kind of comfortable in their own skin, you know?
Yeah.
And so are the actors in many ways.
Yeah, it
and
is
so,
noticeable
yes.
compared with season one.
Yeah. So I got to give this episode a good, I don't know why I wouldn't. I think I'm just going to give it 5 out of 5 Quark brands on the head. So.
Oh, God. So that's a painful rating,
yes,
Matthew.
It's a painful rating, but it's a high one. So.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I share the thoughts that you just said there. It's a great start to the season. It feels like the series progressed from season one to season two. Season two ended so strongly. And talking about whether we knew going into the episode that it was going to be a cliffhanger to start the season, it's interesting that we had grown so accustomed with The Next Generation to every season of Star Trek ending with a cliffhanger. And then when Deep Space Nine season one did not end with a cliffhanger, there was no to be continued on the screen. That felt odd. And then you go into the second season and then you get it. And so right there, it was, it's an unexpected little twist, but yeah, they're just doing so much with the story. And season one was great, but you can see the richness in the machinations going on in the writer's room here as they're setting up what they're going to be doing. And it's on full display here. So I think it's a really fantastic episode, and I'm going to give it 9 Ractogenos with a Jack O'Rine peel.
Nice. Fantastic.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on the homecoming. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. And it is a closed group, so if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll see a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to us by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is trekfm. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a review and a rating, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not examining what you're paying for, where can people find you?
Well, you could find me all over the place under the name MattRushing02. You can also find me here on the network in the 602 Club talking about all of the franchises we love outside of Star Trek. Over on the Nerd Party Network, you could find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills talking about Star Wars each and every week, and Owl Post, which is a Harry Potter podcast talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to figure out how to get that replicator to give you that Jekyll peel just perfect, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm asking Quark to tweak the replicator a bit, which is probably a bad idea because
it's probably who knows
what he's going to do with it. But anyway, when I'm not doing that, you can find me, as you mentioned, elsewhere on the network with you talking about all sorts of Star Trek series. You can also find me in many episodes in the back catalog across lots of shows. Sometimes Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room together as well. So if you'd like to hear my thoughts on a wide range of Star Trek, just dig into the back catalog and those other shows. You can also find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active these days, but I'd love to chat with you wherever you are. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, please visit patreon.com/trekfm to find out how to support the network. It takes a great deal of money to produce and distribute these shows, and we would not be here without the support of everyone who is helping us now. So thank you so much to all of you who are supporting us on Patreon. And if you're not, we hope that you'll take a look and help us keep all of these things going. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time as we jump into the second part of the story with the Circle.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to get there, but thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.